We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
On Focus today, we're talking about a very interesting book that's come out of a study of young adults in America. It's a book written by Christian Smith and others from Notre Dame. It's called Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood. And we're talking with Professor Smith from Notre Dame. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Great. All the technology is working.
Great.
We'll have to do our part. I found this a fascinating book, and I'd like to just sort of get into it in an odd way, perhaps. But
okay.
I thought we would start with chapter 4, talking about sex.
Okay.
And, that'll get people interested, and then we'll, then we'll get into some of the other issues. And I'd like to then close this hour with talking about your first chapter, morality, the issue of morality, and your last chapter, your conclusions, and civic engagement, and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the way I'd like to proceed. And let me, of course, invite listeners to participate. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the host for this program of Focus, sitting in for David Inge, who's taking some time off. But we're always eager to have listeners ask questions, make comments, share their experience. So the way to do that is by phone, 333-9455. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana listening area, that's within area code 217. Again, that's 333-WILL. If it's a long-distance call for you, if you're listening elsewhere in Illinois or in Indiana, I don't think our broadcast range goes completely up to Notre Dame, but it's close. but also, if you're listening online anywhere in the world, really. But you may call us from the continental U.S. at an 800 number, 222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-WILL. Now, Christian Smith is the Keenan Professor of Sociology at the University of Notre Dame. He's also the director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Society. He also directs the Notre Dame Center for Social Research. He's a PI. He's principal investigator of the National Study of Youth and Religion and the principal investigator of the Science of Generosity Initiative. He's the author of three books, at least, Souls in Transition, Moral Believing Animals, and Soul Searching, and the most recent book, Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood. Professor Smith, you and your colleagues interviewed starting, I guess, 2008, over, 230 different young adults all across the country from a broad spectrum of backgrounds. Why did you do it?
Yeah, actually, we started interviewing them in 2002. This is an overtime project, so we...
Oh, that's right. This is your third look at
third
them.
Third wave, yeah. We started off when they were 13 to 17, and we've been following them as they grow up. So this book... focuses on them when they're 18 to 23. And this book comes out of a larger project focusing on teenagers and young adults, or what we call emerging adults, trying to understand their lives better, the institutional and social and cultural forces that shape their lives, the kind of trajectories their lives are on, the kind of outcomes that they experience based on earlier life experience. And the project happens to have had a particular focus on their religious and spiritual lives, but we also ask about lots and lots of other dimensions, trying to get a holistic picture of their lives. So we're sociologists. We try to understand how people's experiences and life outcomes are shaped by, you know, their place in society and culture.
You talk about the dark side of sexual freedom for these young adults, age 18 to 23. Why is there a focus on the dark side?
Yeah, in general, the book is explicitly upfront that it's about the dark side of emerging adult life. There are other books that focus on happier, better aspects of being in your 20s. But after doing our research and interviewing, you know, these 230 young adults around the country, it struck us that there are some problems in their lives that are worth attending to that oftentimes don't get the kind of attention in books and scholarship and in the media. One of which we talk about in this chapter, and that is emerging adults today have inherited from their boomer parents and grandparents the sexual revolution, and they experience a culture of kind of hooking up, easy, casual, relationship-less sexual encounters. And I think most people know that, but I think what a lot of people don't know is that while everyone doesn't experience this, there's an awful lot of trauma and pain and difficulty and relational mess that comes out of a lot of emerging adults' experience hooking up. It struck us when we were doing interviews that a lot of them sort of get into the hookup culture, get over their heads, realize this is much more big and powerful part of life going on. And so we just wanted to draw attention to this more of a shadow side, the betrayals, the deep sense of loss that some experience, and confusion, being bonded to people and then having it mean relatively little or having those people leave them. Not to mention the sexually transmitted diseases and unplanned pregnancies and abortions and so on. In other words, it's just a sum. There's a lot of trouble that goes along with these practices that often doesn't get sort of owned up to in the media. And a lot of emerging adults, when they get into trouble, they don't want to talk about it because sure. They feel shameful about it. So we're just trying to put this side of things on the table as a point of discussion.
And although you focus throughout the book on the dark side of emerging adulthoods in terms of abuse of alcohol and other drugs and sexuality and consumerism and all these things, you also are, I thought, quite fair at also pointing out some of the sort of positive things that have happened in relation to sexuality. You point out that there have been fewer unplanned pregnancies, fewer abortions in recent years, and that's certainly good for those individuals and society.
Yeah, it'd be easy to mistake this book as a sort of the sky is falling, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, but that's not really our story in the book. We're trying to recognize that there's a balance of good and bad, problematic and happy things going on in these people's lives, and this book just happens to focus on one side. The other thing I think it's important to recognize in our book is we're not blaming the young people particularly. One of the main themes of the book is that most problems that young people wrestle with come to them from the adult world that they're being socialized into. So this isn't a running down the kids these days kind of book. It really turns the mirror onto our entire culture and society and asks some deeper questions about our own commitments and values and practices.
Let's talk for a few minutes about some of those things in relation to sexuality. You talk about the shadow side of sexual liberation, and you write this in your second paragraph here, this chapter. For a significant number of emerging adults, especially but not exclusively women, sexual freedom is accompanied by real hurt, confusion, grief, anger, and regrets. This is the darker side of America's cultural sexual freedom that we think is far too often hidden and ignored. And you write that our aim here as sociologists, as scholars, is to bring it to light, to let people look at it and think about it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when we went into this phase of the research project, I wasn't planning on writing this book, but just spending hours and hours talking with different kind of young people all over the country, I was so impressed with the difficulty and the challenge and the grief that so many of them struggle with in various parts of life that after I wrote the first book about their religious lives, I just felt compelled to speak to these other areas, almost to represent their voices in a more public debate. There's just a lot more hurt and grief and trauma that goes on with regard to the hookup culture than many people recognize.
Let's talk about the hookup culture a bit. That may be a phrase new to some of our listeners, although it's been used quite a bit in recent years. You describe in the book how difficult it is to know what young adults mean when they say they hooked up with someone. Did it mean they just spent several hours in deep conversation, or did they have various degrees of sexual intimacy? How did you make your way through that difficulty?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things we do in our interviews is just ask everyone we talk with to explain to us not only sort of what their lives are like and what their friends' lives are like and so on, but what do they mean by these things? If they say they hooked up with somebody, what the heck does that mean? And basically what they tell us is, well, it's really unclear, it's very murky. So the part of the very nature of hooking up is the ambiguity involved, both in what actually happens, but also in sort of to the extent to which people know each other, what their intentions for the future are, if they're really romantically interested. It's all sort of mysterious and murky. And that even comes into play when some young people brag to their friends the next morning, oh, I hooked up with this chick. The murkiness means people don't even entirely know what the person is saying.
Sure.
So that's just part of a larger sense of confusion or ambiguity around sort of sexual practices that gets a lot of young people into trouble.
What percentage of your 230 sample were married?
At age 18 to 23, not that many at all. The average age of marriage for young adults today is in the late 20s. Men get married 2 years later than women, I think age 27 and women 25. But at 18 to 23...
And that's a big change from 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's one of the huge changes creating emerging adulthood. But at age 18 to 23, most young people are not married. The vast majority are not married, not intending to get married for a long time. Some of those who are married are so because they got somebody pregnant or they got pregnant and decided just to get married. But a planned kind of intentional marriage usually happens many years later.
And let's give some of the statistics for listeners. We want them to buy your book, of course, but let's share some of the very interesting information. Of your sample, 71% reported they'd had oral sex, 73% had sexual intercourse. The average age for both oral sex and first sexual intercourse is 16 years old for this sample. You point out that your concern in this book is not primarily how things have changed from 30, 50, 100 years ago. You really want to focus on who these people are today and what this means for them. What does it mean for young adults today to be so sexually experienced so young?
Well, for a lot, it's just something that they have always grown up thinking, well, when you become a late teenager, you just do this. This is just something you're expected to do. And so it almost has more of a force of just going along with a current and living up to normative expectations than a positive choice they make. Some of them even said, my first time I had sex was with somebody I didn't care anything about because I didn't want it to be a big deal. I just wanted to sort of get it over with. So actually, whereas maybe baby boomers had this idea that having sex outside of marriage was really rebellious, today it's just kind of prosaic. It's just something you do. It's just something that happens at a party. It's not a big deal. And it shouldn't mean any kind of attachments necessarily to anyone. So in some ways, the freedom part of it has actually sort of, you might say, degenerated into a kind of a ordinary, prosaic, what's the big deal feel to it. And on the other hand, a lot of young people get the message from the media that sex is going to be this sort of all wonderful, life-fulfilling experience, and then they end up quite disappointed that, like, what's the big deal?
And you also point out very realistically that there are problems with people being so casual about sex that they often go into a sexual encounter without being properly prepared to with condoms or whatever, so that STDs are around at a terrible rate, and there's still There's still occasions where there's a forced sexual encounter, there's rape, these kind of difficulties that, of course, have always been here, but the current attitude seems to make them more prevalent, you report.
Yeah, and we know from studies of adolescent brains that the capacity to balance rewards and risky consequences is not fully formed. And so people get in situations where they end up acting in some kind of impulse, but and there's sort of this idea, well, the bad stuff happens to other people, not me. And then it's a rude awakening to realize bad stuff happens to me, too. Another dimension that you just pointed to is when casual sex is often mixed up with drinking alcohol and intoxication for various reasons. And that often leads to situations of ambiguity of consent. That is, whether somebody really was interested in becoming sexually involved, but because they're so sloshed or sometimes even nearly knocked out, you get situations where one person thinks they were raped on a date rape and another person thinks she consented, which creates huge, you know, problems, obviously legal and otherwise. So it the casualness mixed with intoxicating substances creates even more complicated situations.
In your book, you've very carefully lay out where you come from and you and your colleagues, what your values are that you started off with in this, which I found very helpful to read. But you make clear in several places in the book, in this chapter and elsewhere, that you're very much in favor of sex. You're not a prude, and you're not out to try to dissuade people from their practices. You're trying to study what they are and see what the consequences are. Isn't this a bit of an unusual approach for a supposedly uninterested sociologist?
Yeah, most sociology would like to think of itself as objective somehow, completely unbiased. But and there's a certain version of that that I endorse. But I really think what sociologists are after is not objectivity, but the truth of the matter. And truth is a value commitment, that we want to get to the truth even if we don't like what it is. So, and in this kind of book particularly, which is a certain version of a public sociology or a critical sociology, it's simply impossible to write this kind of book from an objective or neutral standpoint. I mean, simply by saying something is a problem or it deserves discussion implies that you have an orientation or a commitment or a set of values or a vision of what's good against which the reality is difficult or problematic. So we decided right up front, just to state in black and white in the introduction, here's what we think is good when it comes to moral reasoning. Here's what we think is good when it comes to civic involvement or mass consumerism or intoxication or whatever. And so I hope that our argument is much more nuanced and much more sort of cards laid on the table than is often done. But you're right, that's not a typical social science approach, but we thought it was necessary, especially for this book.
Let me reintroduce our guest. We're talking today on Focus with Christian Smith, who is the Keenan Professor of Sociology at Notre Dame and the author, along with some colleagues, of Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood. Professor Smith is a sociologist, as you've just heard him explain. And we're talking about some of the issues he raised in this book today. If listeners would like to join in the conversation, do give us a call. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana 217 listening area. If you're outside of that, toll-free call 800-222-9455. Professor Smith, let's move just quickly to Chapter 3, Intoxication's Fake Feeling of Happiness.
Mm.
And again, you're not against alcohol. You talk about the good things that drinking alcohol can do. You even say that you and I think several others of your colleagues are in favor of legalizing marijuana, of lowering the drinking age. But yet you see some major problems with the way drinking is done by this 18 to 23 age group today. Talk about some of the problems.
Yeah, so I don't have a big problem with people drinking per se, but what struck us as more worrisome is just why the compulsion to get intoxicated. Is it not possible to have a party or a dance or get together with friends or go up to someone of the opposite sex and introduce yourself without first getting yourself under the influence of alcohol? And especially in college contexts, including here at Notre Dame, you have to ask, why is it that alcohol has to be part of so many things? Is there something also wrong with living a sober life? Have young people, or maybe all of us, become so inept at communicating with strangers that first we need to have a couple of beers before we can initiate a conversation? And the other piece of this is, health statistics sort of make our eyes glaze over. But the reality is, and I see this on college campuses, people get hurt. I mean, people drive cars and get in automobile accidents. People kill each other. People fall out of windows. People get in fights for no reason whatsoever. Some people become addicts, alcoholics in college even, without even admitting or realizing it. Others that we interviewed talked about how a lot had sort of gotten past it, but they talked about how, smoking marijuana way too much was getting in the way of their studying well or thinking well or being able to do their job well. Some of them talked about they were smoking pot so much that at work they would have a business phone conversation and hang up and then be able to, the very next second, not be able to remember who they were talking to or what about, which was something of a wake-up call to them. So, again, it's not that we need a puritanical society, but it's that there are deeper cultural questions. What drives people to need to intoxicate themselves so much? Is this some kind of a medicating ourselves because life is either too empty or too difficult or too boring or what? So the chapter is not so much hammering away at drinking per se, but asking what we think are deeper cultural probing questions about what does all this mean, what's behind this.
And you mentioned that for this age group, 18 to 23, many of them started drinking and smoking marijuana and other drugs, 12, 13, 14 years old. Some that you interviewed this time in 2008, age 18 to 23, were already describing themselves as recovering alcoholics.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've interviewed people who are recovering alcoholics or alcoholics, or still alcoholics, and they're just struggle with it all the time. Or even I interviewed a 20-year-old who's a recovered heroin addict. I mean, just completely wrecked her life, completely wrecked her family's life. By age 20, I had already been through rehab and so on, and when I interviewed her, was trying to piece her relationships and some kind of education back together. So in some cases, it starts young. It gets very heavy and has devastating consequences already by the time people are just turning into their 20s.
We have a couple callers waiting. Let's go quickly to line number one. You're on Focus.
Hi. I'm just kind of curious. I've been listening to the show this day, today, and it sounds to me like a lot of the study that you've done is very Catholic moral-based. As somebody who was formerly Catholic and has since chosen a non-Christian faith-based program myself, it sounds to me like a lot of what your research is showing is very much from a Catholic standpoint. And I'm just curious to know, how much that has, for lack of a better word, tainted your study.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say it hasn't tainted it at all. If you read the introduction, you find out that when we describe what we think is good in human life, we put it in very general terms that we think engages all sorts of kind of Americans, religious and not religious. We say that the issues we raise in the book should be of concern to conservatives, right-wingers, but liberals and progressives as well. So this is not,
of concern? I mean, considering that swatch that you just mentioned, that they have very different morals. So it seems
But the morals are not absolutely not overlapping. I mean, all these people care about some basic things about the well-being of their children and their neighbors' children. And I think that there's a kind of a common ground that people can come together and say, you know, it's not good when people drink alcohol and drive an automobile. That's not a religious or not religious issue. That's a basic human kind of issue.
Right, but that's not the kinds of things that you've been talking about. What you've been talking about is having sex. What you've been talking about is having a beer. I mean, that seems to me to cross that line into more of the Christian morality rather than a more liberal perspective.
Yeah, well, I guess I would say if you read the book, you see it's more balanced than that. We started off with the sex chapter, but there are other chapters about not being politically engaged, not being environmentally aware, being
consumerism,
sold out to mass consumer capitalism. And again, it's not even having a beer. Anybody can have a beer as far as I'm concerned. I'm talking about getting sloshed to the point where you're unconscious and somebody's taking advantage of you sexually.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. And we're going to need to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our caller on line 4.
On the next Fresh Air, Afghanistan's brutal crime family, the Haqqani Network, which was behind the recent attack on the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan. We talk with New York Times correspondent Mark Mazzetti. The network acts as a veritable arm of Pakistan's intelligence agency, according to Admiral Mike Mullen, the departing head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
We're back on Focus with our guest today, Professor Christian Smith, author, along with colleagues, of Lost in Transition: The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood, published by Oxford University Press. We have a caller waiting on line number 4 to talk with our guest. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wondered if your guest, two questions, had ever read Wilhelm Reich's character analysis and construction that he describes. And the second question is, how do we reconcile patriotism and all the things that are confronting humanity that have evolved out of that paradigm? Thank you, and I'll ring off.
Professor Smith?
The answer to the first question is, I don't believe so. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe you can help clarify what he was after with the second question.
I wasn't sure, and he rang off before I could ask, too. He was asking about how to reconcile patriotism, but I think with the philosophy of Wilhelm Reich, but I don't know enough about Reich to help you with that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer that.
Okay.
The one thing I can say about patriotism, this probably is not an answer to his question, but you know, most emerging adults still believe in the American dream. They want to be successful. They want a good career. They want a happy family, house, picket fence, dog, kids, vacation home, financial security. So there's very, very little alienation from the American way of life. And although young people have been concerned, I think, about the wars overseas, I think there's still pretty positive regard for America as a nation.
In partial response to the earlier caller, the first caller we had who asked about your starting points, maybe it's fair to go, now that we're in the second half of the program, to your introduction and first chapter, where you talk about what you think is good. And you have in your introduction a section naming what is good. You acknowledge that social science should avoid distorting biases, and yet you point out that good social science does have values. It's committed to scientific integrity, accountability, finding out what's going on in a realistic way. And then you point out that you think there are some values that you as social scientists had in going into this particular study, that you felt it was important to that people learn how to carry on a constructive discussion about moral differences with people they disagree. You point out that it would be good to not become exhausted by materialistic consumption. You think it's good for people to have loving relationships, to find time to be in service to other people. Where did you come up with these?
Well, I think, there are four authors of this book, and we all have different backgrounds and histories, but I spend a lot of time reading and thinking from a lot of different perspectives about what makes for a good society, what human beings are like, and what makes for human flourishing. And if anything, I'm kind of an Aristotelian with these things, where I want to know what kind of practices and virtues lead to a flourishing human life of whatever cultural, moral, religious, whatever approach it might take. I think human beings, there are certain things that are good for us and certain things that are not particularly good for us. And some things, it depends. But some of the notions of the good that we put in this book have to do with where the United States is in particular. So, for example, the chapter on moral reasoning, the larger issue at stake there is, can people explain themselves to others, first of all, and can different people who have different perspectives engage in a constructive discussion where they explain, here's what I believe, here's what you believe, here are our assumptions, how does that make us different, and how can we move on from there? Can we understand each other better? Can we get along more in cooperation than in just ignoring each other or fighting with each other? Now, it seems to me that that's a huge thing that our culture has gotten pretty bad at, and it would help our society generally if we learned how to better have civil conversations, constructive discussions across real differences, people that really disagree. We need that as a country, and the fact that we saw in the young people we studied a kind of an inability to do that, even to explain where they were, what their commitments were, and why they believed what they believe, much less evaluate different points of views. I just think that that's troubling for a democracy where there's a lot of pluralism. If we're a pluralistic society and we want to carry on with any degree of coherence, we need to be able to have constructive conversation. And again, that's not a matter of a particular theological or ethical point of view. That's a matter of functioning society.
You talk about these problems partly being a result of an inadequate education that these young people you interviewed, 18 to 23 in age, have experienced. Most of them had been to high school and college, and yet they seemed so inarticulate when it came to explaining even what they thought, why they did what they did. How can universities and colleges be better, and secondary schools?
Yeah, I think I think universities and colleges are somewhat better than secondary schools, but part of the challenge is in our public education system, you know, the schools cannot be, by constitutional interpretation, they cannot be promoting one particular vision of what a good life looks like or what a comprehensive account of what is good. And so what I've observed in studying young people for more than 10 years now is what they report is anytime there's a subject that comes up that could cause disagreement or could cause someone to get upset, the teachers just sort of avoid it, kind of like a dysfunctional family that has sets of things they can't even talk about. And so young people get through a school system not having been trained or informed or modeled how people with different points of view can sort of sort out those differences and work them through. It's completely understandable. I mean, a teacher's first job is to keep order and creating conflict, even if it's educational conflict, if it's constructive conflict, is threatening. And no principal wants to be sued by any sort of half-cocked parent who misunderstands what's going on in the classroom. So the collective result is sort of avoiding engaging in difficult but important issues. Colleges, of course, can can have more of a chance to get into philosophy classes and engage more normative issues at a more advanced level. But you know, half of the young people don't go to college, and a lot of young people do go to college. They're there for technical degrees, not learning how to engage moral reasoning.
And you point out that the humanities have really gotten pushed very much to the margins.
Yeah, what used to be very important in higher education, asking big questions, the humanities, the arts, and so on, is becoming increasingly marginal, and science, engineering, technology, mathematics, business, and so on are becoming more and more important in higher education. Well, all of which may be functional for society and people's careers, but somewhere along the way, people are not learning how to think, how to reason morally and engage with people who are different from them.
And lives often seem very narrow.
Yeah, there's this is the second chapter in the book, focuses on just sort of a sold-out commitment to mass consumer materialism, that really the vision of what a good life is for the majority of emerging adults is financial security, being able to consume things, going shopping, and so on. Not all, but for the majority, that's the reality. And that took me by surprise, because I went into this thinking, well, 18 to 23-year-olds are much more environmentally aware, maybe trying to live modestly, maybe consuming, you know, intentionally around what's fair trade or the global good. But we found very, very little of that.
Let me quote from your concluding chapter about this. You say, having freed people from the formative influences and obligations of town, church, synagogue, extended family, conventional morality, American individualism has exposed those people to the more powerful influences and manipulations of mass consumer capitalism. All-pervasive advertising, credit card buying, all of this. And then you propose a thought experiment too. Would you want to say something about that? I found that quite revelatory.
Well, first of all, the main idea of that passage is it's not the case that humans are not influenced by the social world around them. One way or another, we're influenced by the social world around us. And in the past, it's been small-town gossip, or maybe, you know, a particular religious community or an ethnicity. But we're living in an illusion if we think that, having been freed from those things, young people and all of us are not heavily influenced by advertising, the structure of the economy, and a lot of other social forces. And in some ways, I think those things can be more powerful in distorting people or getting them to follow the crowd than some of the other influences. Why don't you explain what you mean by the thought experiment, and I can sort of elaborate on it.
I was just quoting your book. You talk about a thought experiment of a different world. Imagine one where young adults knew their limits and looked to more experienced adults for teaching and wisdom. Think of a society where structures of social life fostered real community.
Yeah. So these things are almost impossible to imagine, perhaps, but you know, the society can develop in different directions, and it's not out of the question that there could be more relationships between young adults and older adults, that young adults could learn to reason more carefully about the choices they make in life, that they could realize life is about more than just shopping and buying and consuming and throwing things out. Possibly, I mean, this is hard to say in today's political climate, but young adults may realize, you know, they need to contribute to the common good, that they need to be politically involved, whatever their politics are, to be actively involved in our republic and not just sort of write it off as hopeless.
We have a caller waiting I want to get to very quickly, but let me just quote one of your statistics at this point, where you point out that only 2% of this age group currently that you interviewed are actively political.
Yeah, and we were very surprised by this, because during the last presidential campaign, there was a lot of talk about how active young people were in politics, and there's almost this new John F. Kennedy era when young people were hopeful and getting involved and giving money and campaigning. But by the time we talked to them, nearly every last emerging adult was quite hopeless, despondent about the prospects of the larger world. It just felt impossible to deal with, almost despairing about any possibility to do anything in the larger civic realm. And so they mostly ended up focusing on their own personal lives. That's where they thought they could make a difference.
Let's go to line number one, and let me repeat the phone numbers for others who'd like to join this conversation. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, the 217 area code. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. Line number one, you're on,
thank you.
On the air.
I wanted to ask two questions. I know you're focusing primarily on American youth in terms of your survey, but I noticed when you were talking about consumer, capitalist, whatever other category you put together in terms of describing how you saw it, I wonder if this isn't a worldwide phenomena. Certainly in Europe and in Asia, China, India, you have a cohort of teens and 20s who are similarly driven by these sorts of goals. So that's you could talk about that, or you could simply say, you know, you don't have the information, be that as it may. The other part that I wanted to bring up was the fact that the possibilities for youth is obviously tied in with our changing economic situation, both here in Europe and worldwide. The tremendous economic recession, depression, and the very limited opportunities. I could just say I have a daughter who is completing her doctorate, and it's in terms of finding postdoc positions or academic positions, both here and in Europe. She happens to be in Europe. It's quite terrible, and the choices have to be made which really don't sustain further growth in those areas. So I'll stop and let you talk about that.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think both of those observations and questions are fantastic, actually. So to speak to the first one, what we're describing is not a uniquely American phenomenon. Emerging adult, all of this is set within the context of this idea of emerging adulthood. And emerging adulthood is the period of time between being a teenager, dependent on parents, and being a fully settled down, responsible, independent adult. And so the idea of emerging adulthood is that this period of time has been stretched out longer and longer in the American life course in the last decade. So you can go for a decade being an emerging adult, neither a teenager nor a fully settled down adult. Well, back to the caller's question. Emerging adulthood and the culture that goes with it is not just an American thing. It seems to arise in many societies where you have material prosperity and where the economy is driven by knowledge, and so that requires a lot of higher education to be successful. Also, when there's a culture that has more of a sort of an Anglo-liberal individualism in it, that sort of fosters this idea that each person is their own final authority and can live however they want to. So I would agree. I think that there are common threads of this in many places of the world, especially where the economies are booming or have had a lot of prosperity for a while, including Europe, Australia, New Zealand, even making inroads in Japan, China, just starting to make inroads in India, and so on. So it's a global phenomenon for societies that are at a certain stage of socioeconomic development. So I think that's a really good observation. The second question, can you remind me what the second question was now?
Boy. Sorry, I didn't get it written down. I was writing down the first one.
Yeah, it was also another excellent... Oh, about the prospects given the recession.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
right.
So that's also another great observation. And people who are coming out of high school and college today and graduate school are in a real crunch because most of them do have high expectations. They do think that they're going to have successful prosperous lives, and I'm glad that they have that kind of outlook.
And they're often being supported by parents, you point out, during this much longer time than before.
Yeah, support that makes a lot of this happen. But increasingly, you know, year by year, with every May graduation, the young people are realizing that, you know, reality isn't going to be able to support their expectations. And so there's a certain amount of having to come to terms with a sort of a grim outlook, at least in the short term. And I know that economic studies show, too, that youth who graduate school during economic times of prosperity do much better over the long run in terms of salary and earnings than those who graduate not during good times. And so that's not a good news for young people today.
We're down to our last 5 minutes. We have two callers waiting.
Yeah, okay.
So do you want to finish that thought, and then we'll get to that?
Yeah, just that... that in some ways that extends emerging adulthood, because it extends dependence on parental support. It extends living at home. The stronger the economy is, the easier it is to settle down, get a job, buy a house, and become a fully responsible adult.
We'll go to a caller on line one. We're down to our last 4 or 5 minutes.
Hi. In the U.S., we barrage young people with advertising. They have it in schools from kindergarten on up. And children's TV, they have so much advertising. It's in what we call the news in the U.S. We have so much entertainment news and fluff that we let in as news. And we say that young people have the problem. So I'm really interested in how the critique and I would even say the criticism in this discussion is falling on youth themselves and not on the culture that defines and bounds youth as material consumers. I think we're very easy in this culture to say that youth are consumers who have a problem. And we have a harder time, especially by calling something emerging adulthood and framing it. We're not looking at what are the forces that are making that happen. Also, with due respect, I really take issue with your findings on youth as not politically active, with about a quarter of youth unemployed, even higher for African-American and Latino youth. You know, young people are feeling like their futures have been sold. Who's occupying Wall Street right now? I guess I'd like you to comment on these things. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, those are fantastic points, and I've been hoping for a chance to get them in. The book actually constantly makes that point, that these problems are not young people's problems. These problems are societal problems. Everything that young people struggle with is rooted ultimately in our larger economic system, our cultural system, our political system. And this has been a theme of many things I've written, that adults like to hammer on teenagers as having teenage problems. But in reality, every problem that young people struggle with come from the adults. A lot of times it's the parents or other adults who supply the drinking and the drugs. It's the entire media system that is, as the caller rightly said, Mick, the line between entertainment and advertising is growing increasingly thin. So I don't want to say that young people are victims, but this is not just a young person's problem. So I totally amen what she has to say on that. That's a major theme of the book.
And I realize I was relying on my memory when I quoted your book in terms of the percentage being who are truly politically active, and it's 4%, not 2%. So I may have misled there too.
Yeah, so there are some who are active, and if you see them in groups, like on a university campus, it may seem like there are more, but the vast majority aren't. And again, that's not even so much a hammering on youth. Why aren't they more political? I mean, in some ways, our leaders have really disappointed them, have really been poor models. Our government hardly seems to be able to function. There's been wars going on for 10 years that don't seem to be able to be stopped. It's unclear why some of them got started. So we actually write in the book, young people are not acting irrationally with some of these things. They're responding to growing up in a difficult world.
We have another caller. Let's try to quickly get them on the air. Yes, Clay City, line number two.
Yes, I find the whole nature of youth has changed dramatically. I blame a lot of it on the culture itself, but I work in a restaurant, and to engage somebody for an extended period of time is almost impossible. For one thing, you have a hard time getting orders from them because they're too busy punching on their cell phones. The nature of way they communicate with themselves has changed in such a way that their attention span is, I mean, it's getting shorter and shorter and shorter. How much has technology played into this? Everybody's got an app phone now.
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly how much, but I'm pretty convinced, and I'm kind of a skeptic when it comes to these things naturally, but I'm pretty convinced that changes in digital communication technology have really had an impact on especially young people's sense of truth and reliability. And there's a certain kind of skepticism, but as the caller pointed in, between television and Facebook and other technologies, attention spans, young people are, we're not teaching young people how to sustain attention to work through a long problem. It's just not part of their lives very much. So I think technology is a piece of the puzzle.
We're down to our closing minute or two. Professor Smith, we've been looking at your book, Lost in Transition, The Dark Side of Emerging Adulthood, published by Oxford University Press. You and your co-authors talk about this cohort from 18 to 23 that you've investigated. I found the book very interesting. Any last thoughts on hopes for the future?
The reason why it's hard to think, well, we'll just make this change and that change and that'll fix everything,
yeah,
is precisely because of what was said two callers ago. The challenges here, the problems are systemic. They're not just if we tweak this or tweak that. The problems are baked into our entire culture and society. So I don't think matters are hopeless. I do, and not all emerging adults reflect the kind of issues or problems we have. Some of them make different choices and lead quite different lives. So in some sense, we're all free to make the choices we make, but we make them within larger structures and situations that sometimes lead people in directions that are not all that good for them. I think parents have a lot more power and influence over their young people than they sometimes imagine, so I hope that the message here is that parents can be more authorized to take responsibility for their children.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking on Focus today with Christian Smith, Keenan Professor of Sociology at the University of Notre Dame, also director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Society, principal investigator for the National Study of Youth and Religion. We appreciated his book, Lost in Transition. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Focus. Any last thoughts on hopes for the future?
The reason why it's hard to think, well, we'll just make this change and that change and that'll fix everything,
yeah,
is precisely because of what was said two callers ago. The challenges here, the problems are systemic. They're not just if we tweak this or tweak that. The problems are baked into our entire culture and society. So I don't think matters are hopeless. I do, and not all emerging adults reflect the kind of issues or problems we have. Some of them make different choices and lead quite different lives. So in some sense, we're all free to make the choices we make, but we make them within larger structures and situations that sometimes lead people in directions that are not all that good for them. I think parents have a lot more power and influence over their young people than they sometimes imagine, so I hope that the message here is that parents can be more authorized to take responsibility for their children.
We're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking on Focus today with Christian Smith, Keenan Professor of Sociology at the University of Notre Dame, also director of the Center for the Study of Religion and Society, principal investigator for the National Study of Youth and Religion. We appreciated his book, Lost in Transition. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Focus.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status, with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
And at 2 minutes before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert, your host for the Afternoon Magazine. We'll have a look now at market numbers at the midday from Kansas City hardware winter wheat in December, 740. That's up 13 and a quarter. March, 755, up 13 and a quarter. Four from Chicago, December wheat, 650 and a half. That's up 11 and a half. March, 683 and a quarter, up 11 and a half. December corn from Chicago, 632. That's up 1 1/4. March, 645 and a quarter, up 1 1/4. May, 653 and a quarter. 653, that's up 1 1/4, and July, 658, up 1 1/4. November beans, 1233 and a quarter, up 9 3/4. January soybeans, 1244 and a half, up 9. March, 1253, night up 9 and a quarter. May, 1260 and a quarter, up 10 and a half. October soybean meal, 317.90, up 250. October soybean oil, 51.76. That's up 21. October live cattle, 120.22 and a half. That's down 17 and a half. December 120.90. That's up 50. October feeder cattle, 139.97 and a half, up 35. October lean hogs, 90.55, up 177 and a half. December lean hogs, 85.90. That's up 242 and a half. Right now in the outside markets, we're looking at crude oil, 82.90. That's up 169. Arbob gasoline, 265.38. That's up 31. Dow Jones Industrial Average, up 170.